joining us today for the 11th episode of the Whitaker Report podcast, a discussion with thought leaders about the future of economic development, site selection, and corporate real estate. My name is Dean Whitaker, President and CEO of Whitaker Associates, a data analytic company serving the needs of economic development and commercial real estate organizations. I will be your host as we endeavor to see around the corner to see what's next. Today we'll be speaking with John Roberts, Principal Managing Director of TIP Strategies, Inc., a strategic planning firm based in Austin, Texas. John has been Principal and Managing Partner at TIP Strategies since 2000. He helped transition the company from its Texas-based site selection practice to a national strategy firm. John's portfolio includes planning work from New York to California with significant regional projects at the Mississippi Delta, Seattle Puget Sounds, and the Great Lakes area. Before joining TIP, John was the Director of Business Development first for the state of Washington and then under Governor Ann Richardson for the state of Texas. During the transition to Governor Bush's tenure, he helped restructure the state's economic development organization and then co-authored a new economic strategy for the state of Texas. John has deep ties to the Pacific Northwest. He was vice president of the Oregon Technology Fund and was the lead investor for the Hood River Brewing Company. He has managed two startup technology companies and has served on the boards of other startup firms. John was the founder of the Fat Tire Mountain Bike Company in Portland, Oregon. John has lectured in business at the University of Washington, the University of Texas, and was on the faculty of Marysburg College at Portland, Oregon. Born and raised in Germany, he has traveled extensively throughout Europe and Asia. John received his BA and MA degrees from the University of Hawaii and did postgraduate work at the University of Oregon. He resides in Austin but spends his summers in Bend, Oregon. He will be speaking with John today on two topics, the long-term impact of remote work and also on the importance of climate change resilience and economic development. Please join me as we welcome John Roberts to the Whitaker Report podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I'm thrilled to be part of this and honored as well.
From the economic development strategic point of view, what are some of the long-term impacts of remote work, especially in light of the workforce for whom that's not an option?
Well, you know, the fascination with remote work is entirely justified in the sense that it affects everything from our commercial and real estate development to transportation and in some ways our relationship to our employers. But that's not the complete picture of remote work, because a significant part of our population, of our workforce, doesn't have the option of working remotely. So we can have a discussion there. I think it's an important one to have about remote work, but only if we also are mindful of those for whom remote work isn't possible. And that's complicated, Dean, as you know, that there are racial divides within remote work.
Yeah, racial and economic divides too, if you look at the income levels and compensation for each of those types, those categories of work that we do.
Well, certainly, and less than one in five Black workers and one in six Latino workers work from home. And the higher wage workers, which are predominantly Anglo, are six times as likely to be able to work from home as lower wage workers. And of course, as we know, leisure and hospitality is a big part of the reason for that, they being largely unable to work from home. And then this is complicated further by those workers with children who, for whom remote work is not as easy as those who don't have children, or for that matter, for those who don't have the higher income to begin with, that affords them the privacy that most work from home environments require. So these are things that we need to be constantly reminded of. And I can give you some more data. I think it's relevant to anyone that wants to chat later about our data sources. I'm delighted to have that conversation. There's just huge gaps by race and ethnicity over the work from home versus the need to actually be at your job. So that, you know, that's something that we in the profession need to be mindful of. And there's a fascinating dialogue, if you will, going on right now, Dean. I think you've read about it as well, the Atlantic Monthly, with David Brooks taking on Richard Florida about what it means to commit to the creative class and the consequences of that for those who aren't part of that, loosely speaking, that class, which can now be defined as those who can work remotely.
Very interesting. I have not read that, but I'll go back and take a look at that. Thank you for the reference.
You bet.
And so what do we do about this? You've been thinking about this for a long time, I can tell. Where do we start to try to address this issue? What do we need to be doing as economic development professionals?
Well, you know, and Dean, you and I have talked about this in the past. The problem, and it is a problem that confounds economic developers, is always around the metrics of, and in particular, the metric of job creation. And in fairness to economic developers, they are put in a box by politicians. And, you know, that hasn't changed over the last 20 plus years. There isn't a single politician, regardless of what side of the aisle that they are on, who isn't emphasizing jobs. You hear it from each administration. And so it makes everyone in economic development feel the need to be responsive to that. What jobs are we creating, and what do those jobs look like, become secondary to, look, we're meeting the politician's objective and our traditional objective. But if COVID-19 hasn't taught us anything else, it certainly, I think, has made us aware of the way we think about jobs and what does productivity mean and what does it mean to be able to work from home versus all those services. And what I'm getting at, of course, is the pay inequities that are driving this discussion.
So we have an inequity in pay for those who have to be on the job site in order to get that pay. And
exactly.
We have those that can work remotely. And then even another category I've stumbled on recently was called the digital nomads, which are literally people that work from anywhere on the planet. And so it feels like we're creating this bifurcated society of two groups of people. And
I'm very leery of throwing out terms without really trying to delve into what we mean when we say them. So I use the term inequity, pay inequities, and that require, and this is a long-winded answer to your question, it requires us to say what we mean by an inequity. And I think in this case, it's relatively simple, Dean. And then a wage inequity means that I am in a full-time job and the compensation for that job does not allow me to meet my basic needs. That's an inequity, I think, by anyone's standards. And it's one that the profession needs to own up to. So if we are creating jobs, loosely speaking, and those jobs don't afford the people who hold them the ability to meet their basic needs, in some cases even pay their rent, then what have we accomplished by, quote, creating jobs, unquote? And so that's where I think this discussion needs to go, and economic developers, among others, certainly politicians, need to take a harder look at this. And so that's really part of the issue. And I don't want this conversation to center entirely around that, because the implications of remote work for those who can work remotely are also a fascinating discussion that mm-hmm. also ripple out. So, you know, this is something we're going to be living with for quite a while.
You'd earlier talked a bit about the idea that it also impacts the real estate market, both residential, commercial, and industrial. Can you expand a little bit on that thought?
You bet. And let's begin with residential real estate, because this is not something that economic developers have paid a lot of attention to in the past. The assumption was that the real estate market will simply be responsive to the overall economic demands of the community, and developers will build houses when it's needed. But we're in a very unusual situation, also compounded by COVID, that has skewed the residential real estate market in a way that we've never seen before. And I think we all know, but it's worth enumerating the reasons for that. One is that we were in an existing imbalance between supply and demand prior to COVID. That was exacerbated by historically low interest rates. And then along comes COVID. So the desire for single family homes reaches a new high. And then I think the fourth component in the residential real estate market that we have overlooked is residential real estate as an investment instrument. Now those of us who paid attention to residential real estate have seen this phenomenon earlier. We saw it in Vancouver, British Columbia, and Canada when residential real estate became an investment play for Chinese investors. Now we're seeing the equivalent of REITs, of real estate investment trusts, just for residential. So speculative investment in real estate has further tightened the market. So all of these four factors combine to put a pressure on residential real estate in a way that we've never experienced it before. And what it means for our profession, Dean, and I know you've thought about this, is that we literally have to step back and say, does it make sense to recruit a company mm-hmm. to our community if there's no place for those people who would be moving there to live? Literally no residential options. And I first encountered this in Wisconsin a couple of years ago. I didn't give it the due that I should have. And now we're seeing it in clients that we have in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and elsewhere, where we've had people in focus groups literally say to us, why do we have a recruitment strategy when we couldn't house the workers at any pay scale, by the way, whether they're in the, in the class of workers that are well compensated and are looking for homes, you know, at $500,000 and more, or whether they're just making ends meet. And that, of course, has rippled out into the rental market as well.
Very interesting. And then there's also the shortage of materials in the construction industry that seems to be adding to the stress on the housing market. Is that what you see?
Absolutely. You know, you see it in the indices of prices of lumber, but compounding that is the same worker issue that I think we're going to, keep circling back on, which is that that the seasonality of construction work has always been troubling from the ability to manage a cash flow for those who are in the construction industry. So you have fewer workers and you have higher materials cost. So absolutely, we're going to see, this is not going to go on forever. You and I know that the economy moves in cycles, and we will catch up. But for the foreseeable future, that is to say, for the next 2 to 3, maybe 4 years, we'll continue to see an inflation of housing prices, and that in turn compounds housing availability in general.
Very interesting. So that's sort of the residential side. What about the commercial and industrial side of the real estate market?
I'm like a lot of people that we talk to on a regular basis about the future of commercial office space in particular. And when we talk about commercial, let's just talk about office space. We've had long conversations with Cushman Wakefield, with JLL, Jones Lang LaSalle, and other developers in major areas of the country. And there's real uncertainty about what commercial office space is going to look like. And you know, we always want to talk in national terms, and there's some validity in doing that. But I think more relevant are the regional markets. And so there's wide differences between what's happening, say, in the Chicago land area, greater Chicago, versus, say, Dallas. And in Dallas, you're seeing continued significant commercial office space construction. Now, what's interesting about that is that and this is a pattern that we've seen in certain metros in the past, especially high growth metros, is that that occurs at the same time that Class B and Class C commercial office remains vacant. And you would think that the market would absorb that beforehand, but that's not the case. You've got demands from developers working on behalf of businesses that are saying we need bespoke office space. And I think the fact that the demands of the design build is changing, those demands are changing. And so the cost of taking a Class B or a Class C, or in some cases, depending on location, Class A office space, and converting it to the needs of a post pandemic design standard aren't worth it. So that, I think the short answer to you is it's a very uncertain future, and it depends very much on what part of the country you're in as to what kind of predictions you want to make about the commercial office market.
Oh, one thing I've been observing is this need to address the HVAC air circulation issue in buildings. I've seen a couple office buildings in Chicago that were not readily reconfigurable relative to the airflow just because of how they were designed. So huge multi-story office buildings are going to be really expensive to try to retrofit.
You're making a really good point, Dean. And you know, we're looking at the possibility of tax credits for the conversion of office space into residential. You've seen that. It's winding its way through Congress. Some version of it may well pass. But the developers that I've talked to, and let me just be more specific, in Dallas and Chicago and Atlanta are the three that we have the most conversations with developers. And their view is dovetails with what you're saying. The costs of meeting the standards that consumers, as well as perhaps the government, will require make those costs prohibitive, even with tax credits. So that change in the market. And then let's also talk about the micro markets. You can have an exodus from downtown. We're seeing that in communities throughout Texas, in metro areas throughout Texas, where you have out migration of workers and corporations to suburban areas. And this, you know, this is another issue that Joel Kotkin has taken up about the future of suburbs. And certainly that is something we as economic developers need to be paying very close attention to, because it changes commute patterns and it changes the position you might take on transportation and other issues.
What a complex issue, all of this. I mean, it's a very complex system. And you poke at one place and something happens somewhere else.
Well, it does. And, you know, and I think it's this to underscore your point, you know, you've got industrial and retail, which we haven't talked about, that are also going through their own upheavals. Right now, there isn't anyone that you would talk to pretty much anywhere in the country who isn't describing this as the golden age of industrial development. And so land that might otherwise have gone for mixed use or residential is being taken by industrial, and industrial to include obviously logistics and distribution. So that, you know, that has complicated the kind of positions that we take. Once again, as you well know, Dean, exacerbated by the what creates jobs question. And while the industrial development certainly does create jobs, certainly not at the numbers it has in the past. And so the question of what are you giving up land for, especially if you incentivize it, is something that we as a profession need to have legitimate answers to.
For a long time, I've felt that our communities are sitting on an enormous resource called people and need to husband those. And I'm sure in your strategic work, you're talking with your clients about that very issue of the natural resources of land and other resources, but also their people resources. And when you invest those in a company as a community looking at their portfolio, and they invest those resources into a company that's going to locate or expand in their community, then how do they go about making that decision as to where to bet their chips?
It's a discussion that has been long in coming to the economic development world. And let's expand economic developers to include public policy. And by public policy, I mean things like the comprehensive plan that's prepared by the planning departments of cities and counties. And what I'm driving at here is the larger question of what can be described as how wide is our lane in economic development? How broadly should we think about some of the questions that that are now being raised for us, even if we weren't comfortable with them? And your question is exactly in that space. You know, are we obliged to think about more than just creating the conditions for job growth? And I think the answer to that question is we have to get outside of our lane, Dean. We can't just live within the space of we've created the conditions under which job growth can occur, and we can move on to that next opportunity to do the same. And the reasons for it, we've touched on some of them. If the jobs we're creating don't allow a worker, if it's not a livable wage, if it's if residential options aren't available to them, if job opportunity, that is for growth within a profession, isn't possible, then how have we, again, to step outside of our lane, how have we contributed to the greater vitality of the community? And I think that question is not one that we can duck any longer, and we simply have to move outside of our lane. And I think probably the one thing that has always bedeviled economic developers is how committed they should be to education. Mm-hmm. And the answer is they should be very committed to it and not treat that as someone else's issue.
As you know from your data, I'm sure, as education and income are correlated one-to-one.
Yes.
And so as we invest in education, we're also investing in our economy. And I was watching the school bus the other day at a very densely populated area in my community, and watching all these children get on the bus. And then I see older people thinking, well, I paid for my children to get educated. Why do I have to pay for theirs? And you kind of get that mentality going. And I'm watching all these little future workers, I'll call them that, getting on the bus. And I think if we don't invest in those, we're making a big mistake.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, from my background that I did not grow up in the United States, and the emphasis on a college education has really complicated things for us. And we've talked with enough employers to know that the workforce development system, which is supposed to address this, is not doing so. And there's a failure not only in that system, but also in the way that workforce development connects to economic development. Every honest conversation, and there have been many, with major employers that I've had say, you know, what we really want is people who for whom a basic education is transferable into the training that we can provide. You know, give me someone who can convert a decimal to a fraction, and that we'll go from there. And not, you know, and this will sound like a criticism of the community college system and the workforce development system. And I suppose, Dean, it is. Mm-hmm. Because to the extent that the community college is an effort to backfill a failed high school education, that's not a path forward. So we need to own up to that. And be honest about it. And I think the way that employers have put it to me, and this sounds shocking, it is shocking, that a college education is simply a proxy for worker reliability, and nothing more. And that's a very sad reality, and it's one, as I was alluding to, that is not the case in Germany. I won't speak for the rest of Europe or the world, but it's certainly true there that the value of a college education in terms of the earning power and productivity of that worker is not correlated and shouldn't be correlated. So that we're in a very difficult situation right now, and the lack of an honest discussion about what a high school education actually means to an employer is one that we have not had and we need to have.
You mentioned earlier the word productivity. I was kind of curious about how is that being impacted by our employers as they look at productivity in light of remote work and also in terms of COVID-19?
Well, again, you and I know that productivity is a term of art, right? And it's really about the rate of output per unit of input, I mean, to put it in economic terms, right? And so, but in common parlance, productivity is the degree to which a worker can contribute to the value of the goods and services that that they touch. And so the productivity question is disconnected from the jobs creation question, Dean. And again, these are things that I think we all know. We use different language to describe it. And the reason it's disconnected is that the more productive a company becomes, the lower its demand for workers. And so these are things that we know. I think everyone who thinks about this knows it, but it's very hard to talk about. And we can see it in terms of automation. We can see it in terms of AI, in terms of artificial intelligence, the way that the Internet of Things has changed the role that workers have traditionally played in the industries that they're in. I think the economic development profession needs to have a reckoning here about the disconnect between productivity growth and job growth.
If you go back to the 70s, even as late as that, and you look at the growth in productivity, which has been pretty significant, but not wages, and you've seen wages remaining flat and productivity going up, and it looks like that gap, that increase in productivity, has gone to capital rather than to labor. Is that what you see?
Well, we see some element of that, but of equal importance is we see that productivity growth in manufacturing mm-hmm. has meant a flattening and actual decline in manufacturing employment.
Mm,
so it's both things. It's both a flattening of wages. Now, it's as you know, it's more complicated than that because you have to factor in the outsourcing in manufactured goods. Again, you know, regardless of your political views of this, the benefits to the consumer have been enormous. You know, I sometimes marvel when I go into a store at how cheaply, say, you can buy a toaster, right? And one that will last forever, as opposed to the ones that I remember my parents having. You know, how is that possible? Well, it's possible through technological innovation on the one hand, and through very low Chinese and Southeast Asian labor rates. So the flattening of wages in the U.S. is more complicated than just productivity.
Mm-hmm.
Not to get into a long discussion of economics, just what it means for us in our profession, that if we are committed to, and we are through innovation, increases in productivity, don't expect that to result in a rise in overall wages or overall employment. So you see the problem for us mm-hmm. in economic development.
That's an interesting observation. I'm going to switch gears now to a slightly different topic because I'm very interested in your thoughts about climate change and the role and aspect of economic development. What should we be looking at relative to climate change, and what role should economic development professionals be playing?
You know, let me personalize this in a way, Dean, and please ask as many probing questions about this as you need to. Our trade organization, International Economic Development Council, IEDC, periodically takes up the question of what they should be researching in the years ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real conflicted view around the climate change question. And part of that is political, as you can well imagine, that when we use the term climate change, we immediately find ourselves in a political divide. And one wishes one of two things, that A, people could see science as not really putting its finger on the scale of the implications of that, of just saying this is what is happening on the one hand, and on the other, to not be obsessed with the language of climate change and the politicization of it, and just say, you know, let's leave aside entirely the question of how much of it is man-made for a moment, and just talk about the fact that we have demonstrably over the last couple of generations, seen climate effects that and weather effects that require us to be far more resilient in how we deal with the environment. And if we were to, and maybe that's not even possible anymore because it is that political, but if we begin with what the things that we can agree on in climate change, which is nobody wants to be without power for an extended period of time. No one wants to be cut off from the internet or not even be able to use their phone. And what are the things that we in our profession can do to address that? So out of the politics and into the hard and detailed work that I think we would be well advised to start thinking about immediately. And the segue to our earlier discussion clearly is around the equity issues associated with that. You and I talked before our interview began about Oregon air quality at the moment, Eastern Oregon. And it's literally at an advisory level where you can't go outside. You literally can't go outside without risking your health. So the reality of this in terms of economic development, I think, is hitting us. And we as a profession need to own up to it and treat it seriously.
Well, when you say health risk, I understand what you're saying in terms of air quality. I noticed I live on the coast of Lake Michigan, actually on the eastern coast, and our air quality here is superb. And I can really feel it when I go into the city like Chicago or other places, just the auto traffic by itself, not to mention the wildfires that are occurring on the West Coast. And ironically, we're also seeing it here in terms of the haze that we see in our sky. So that, you know, it's, what affects one place affects another. And where do you see the economic development profession stepping in to the climate issue, and particularly in resilience? We watched a hurricane come in through New Orleans, Louisiana recently, and work its way all the way up into New York and to the East Coast. What should we be doing to help our communities become more resilient? What are some of the things we could be putting on our agenda?
Not surprisingly, this too is controversial. Let me again, and I don't want to overemphasize the approach of other countries, but when my German relatives come to visit, one of the first things that they've said, and this was long before I even thought much about this, Dean, they would say, they would, you know, in better neighborhoods of the cities, they would be kind of astounded at the fact that our utility lines, our electric lines, weren't underground because it was an eyesore. And it seemed very strange to them that wealthy communities, which in a wealthy country, would not bury their utility lines. Well, you know, that kind of, at the time that they mentioned that, I didn't think about it a lot. And because, again, the number of storms and other events that knock our electricity out weren't as common. Now it's very common. So you have something, I don't want to say simple, but something very clearly within the capabilities of our public entities, our cities and counties, to do. And every time this question is broached to a utility, we hear a plethora of reasons why it isn't feasible to do that. It costs too much. There's property rights issues. We don't want to invoke eminent domain, and on and on. But the cost associated with bringing, and let's just talk about electricity for a moment, back online, once it's knocked out, compared to the sunk cost, pun intended, of burying them in the first place, there's a very clear payout that can be achieved relatively quickly, although cost models of the utilities, especially if you're regulated industry, it's very difficult to get them to be responsive to it. Now there are some externalities here, fascinating ones, which may accelerate that. As you know, among the causes of the wildfires in California and Pacific Northwest in general is that the above ground electric lines can't be kept cool. They spark fires. And so PGE and others are really stepping back and saying, wait a minute, maybe if we're going to be sued, which they have been, maybe we should go ahead and start burying these lines. And when you think of Ida, and you know, we have clients in the New Orleans area, and they're still without electricity. Mm-hmm. Right? You know, and so should we this is a direct answer to your question. What role do economic developers have in climate change? And one of the things that I try to live by, Dean, is that when you make recommendations in a strategic plan, when you work with clients, don't recommend anything that that it wouldn't be good to do, even if the assumptions are wrong about it.
Oh, interesting.
So in that sense, a recommendation that utility lines be buried makes perfect sense, because even if we're wrong and climate change deniers turn out to be right and we face an ice age in 5 years, it still won't have been a bad idea to bury the utility lines.
I hear what you're saying.
So there's no downside to doing it, to having it done. To doing it, it's extremely complicated, but it is an answer to the question of resilience. And it's one where we can weigh in. And this discussion isn't restricted, just, you know, it includes things like broadband access and our unwillingness to take on service providers, the big cable companies. There are states, as you know, Dean, there are states, it's actually a majority of states, that won't allow, the state won't allow the municipality to provide public broadband. Now, that's a political issue, but it's also very much an economic development issue. And there is no, we can't achieve equity, especially around this discussion of remote work and productivity, if all of our citizens don't have access to broadband, all of them. I mean, it's no more realistic to think of a vibrant economy without broadband than it would be to have indoor plumbing or light bulbs.
And I think COVID and work at home has brought that up front and personal. One of the things we've done here in Holland, Michigan, is our Board of Public Works took on 4 years ago, installing broadband throughout the community. And we've done our downtown, and it's a community-owned broadband system. And we have the benefit of having a municipal power plant that generates about a $30 million a year surplus. And so we've taken those funds, some of them, and now invested in our broadband infrastructure. And part of that structure, by the way, is over 20 years old. It was built by our municipal power company to serve their substations when they had a major outage in the early 90s. And the result is we've expanded that system, and because we were in the ground with our own fiber originally, we've been able to get around the issue that you brought up, and that is that the state says no municipality can build their own network. Well, we've said we're grandfathered in because we had ours in the ground in the early 90s, and so far we've weathered that storm. But our city attorney is already preparing to be sued. And so we expect we're going to get sued, and we're already preparing for that lawsuit to come up.
Well, that's a fascinating case that you bring up. And I think this is right at the heart of the question of what does it mean to stay within your lane in economic development? Mm-hmm. And how do you define the lane that we're in? And maybe we're not saying anything more, Dean, than the lane is not defined by job creation alone. That it really speaks to the broader economic vitality of your community. We have clients in Fort Collins who some years ago, before we even became involved with them, that had changed the name of their economic development department to the Department of Economic Health.
Interesting. So
you're increasingly seeing folks within the profession who are willing to tackle these larger questions. And I'd like to add one other dimension to this. To the climate change discussion. There is a generational gap here, Dean, in the urgency with which this is viewed. And again, I'll personalize it. When in February, we in Texas, and of course we made the national news, had an ice storm that crippled our entire electrical grid. It was widely discussed, widely reported, and it felt cataclysmic to a lot of people, especially the younger people on our team, for whom this was traumatic. Now, it didn't feel that way to me, but then, you know, I have the privilege of living in a place where the effects of it. I have a fireplace and firewood, and I can quote weather a storm. And you know, I'm in a much larger space. Those who were in apartments and had no power and no water and no foreseeable exit from that, you can imagine the trauma that. And so I discussed this with all of the younger people that are on our own team, and as well as my own daughter, and came across a phrase that I think we in economic development need to be more mindful of. My daughter's a professor at Portland State University, and the term that she used is she said they were feeling a sense of institutional betrayal. Huh. And that phrase, which I'd not heard before, really resonated with me. And the idea behind institutional betrayal is that the institutional response to crisis had completely failed them. And so what does this have to do with economic development? I think it has a lot to do with economic development because it directly relates to resiliency. It directly relates to the commitment that we have to those for whom a living wage job doesn't actually meet that goal, and felt like a betrayal of future generations. I think the question of the electric grid and ERCOT and all of the detailed discussions that were taken up by the New York Times and others about this do affect us as economic developers, not just because in large measure had we buried those electric lines, we would have survived it, but we weren't committed to the overall health of our economy. And that plays out. I mean, Samsung, which is our major semiconductor chip producer here in Austin, was down for a week. For a week, the productivity, production completely stopped. So we as economic developers, even if we have no moral conscience, even if future generations don't mean anything to us, we can't operate successfully in an environment where disruptions to the electric grid, either by heat or by cold, stymie businesses' ability to operate. So I think this is very much a generational issue as well as an economic development issue.
That's fascinating, and I had not considered the generational impact. Although I have a 45-year-old daughter out in Oregon who probably would weigh in on that question too. And so,
let me take it one step further, Dean. It is literally to the point now where our clients are making us aware that the target industries that typically fall out of a cluster analysis and the kinds of work that we do, you know, based on Michael Porter and everyone else, is a skewed way of looking at our overall economic health. And they're literally saying, if your target industries target companies that contribute to CO2, in other words, if they're polluting industries, why are we doing that? Why should they be target industries? And think about that as a litmus test, and ask yourself, how many times have we really, I mean, we've always in the past, we've just relied, look, if they pass the standards of the Department of Environmental Quality, we're done with it, right? But DEQ doesn't anticipate oil spills. They don't anticipate the cumulative effect of CO2 emissions. And so we have a generation now that is holding us to account on climate change in things like target industries. And even if you were in a community that isn't even remotely affected by this, although I don't know what that community would be, you're indirectly affected because of another topic I know you're going to ask about, and that we've spent a lot of time looking at, and that's talent migration, which is climate migration. So climate migration is a reality. And we actually tracked, as did a number of media sources, the outmigration of working age population from storm affected areas. And I just recently had a discussion with the folks from Puerto Rico about this, and they said that their ability to be economically viable is compromised by the outmigration of a talented workforce due to the storms that they're confronting.
Fascinating. I had an opportunity to work with Evansville, Indiana, in terms of helping them recruit talent. And one of the main sources of people that moved to Evansville was Puerto Rico. And it's because Evansville had a large pharmaceutical industry, as did Puerto Rico. And when they lost power and the inability to function for months, people said, we've got to earn a living. We have families to take care of. And they picked up and moved their families to Evansville, Indiana.
Well, you know, that clearly is a phenomenon that is increasing. We saw it for the first time in a dramatic way with Katrina. We're seeing it now with Ida. Influx, and this is documented. This is not speculative. Into Houston and other areas. In fact, I mean, another one of our clients is in Indianapolis. There's a significant population migration to major metro areas, Indianapolis, Houston, and not just proximate to Puerto Rico or New Orleans, that is a constant with each storm.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. So we are seeing a movement. Then with rising sea levels, we're probably going to even see more migration from the coast, more perhaps inland. Is any of your data showing that?
Well, it's complicated because the reasons for moving don't only involve resilience. So as climate change deniers like to point out, you know, why would people move from Puerto Rico to Florida, where rising sea levels and storms are maybe equal? Well, it's complicated. It's complicated because, you know, you want to move to where you're comfortable in the language and you're comfortable in the culture. And so it's not surprising that they move to Florida. But, you know, will they then move outside of Florida at some point? And the answer is probably. So I'm against simple explanations of anything, whether it's climate or climate migration. But certainly the pattern of outmigration is there, and I don't see how it cannot continue.
Well, we've covered a wide range of topics today, and I really want to thank you for your time, John. Anything you'd like to wrap us up with as far as where you see the economic development profession heading and any other areas that you'd like us to touch on?
Well, you know, I hope this isn't the only opportunity we have to talk about this. And I know that between you and me, it will not be. but I think, you know, for the profession as a whole, just by way of summary, we've come to a reckoning. And you and I first talked about that reckoning with the Great Recession. And the part that the housing market played in that Great Recession. And now we're facing arguably an even more traumatic time as we rebound from it. And I think when I say we're facing a reckoning, it's really a moment where we can step back and we can say, okay, what are the assumptions under which we have operated? What are the incentives that we grant? What are they for? How are they best used? And how do we engage a younger generation, especially around issues of equity and climate change and change notions of what productivity grants us? So that's by way of summary. And again, let me just thank you for having this opportunity. And I hope it's a dialogue If I sound confident about things, I want to backtrack that. I'm not nearly as confident as I may sound. And I'm more than open to people bringing a different perspective to this. But I'm really appreciative of the time spent with you.
Thank you so much, John. You've really given us so much to think about, as well as you bring a perspective, and I love the idea of a reckoning. And I do believe, as you do, that that's where we've arrived to, and now it goes back to how do we shape and train future economic developers to have those thoughts in mind. And I just want to say thank you so much, John, for taking your time today. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you, Dean, and looking forward to seeing you in Nashville.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Whitaker Report podcast, Seeing Around Corners, and a special thanks to John Roberts for helping us better understand the changes taking place in economic development. Again, I'm Dean Whitaker, your host. Thank you for listening.